Setlist in association with 7 Digital.
This week, Rainbow Venues, Steely Dan and Slush Music. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Hello there.
Hello. And hello, listeners. You join us in a different setting this week.
We've taken the podcast on tour.
Yeah, something like that.
Due to all-round busyness in our usual studio, unfortunately, we weren't able to record in our usual slot. But do not fear, because we have the technology with which to go on tour.
Yeah.
We just need somewhere to go to, and we managed to find somewhere.
We did. Well, we normally record in East London. This week, we're in West London.
Hence the tour.
Is very, very different, as anyone outside of London, well, I'm sure, will agree.
You can almost sense the difference, ambiance, just because we're... normally we record pretty east, although as someone who lives much further east...
Yeah, all right.
East-ish.
Yeah.
But we're pretty west.
We are.
We're in Shepherd's Bush.
We
and
are.
We're not West End, it's like proper West London.
Yeah, we're at the offices of IE Music.
Who we must say thank you to.
Yes, and to Stephen O'Reilly, who stepped in at short notice to provide us with the studio at IE Music.
Yes, so he has given us a space where we could bring our technology to, set it up, a nice little room that is soundproofed, so we won't have... you remember the last time we went on tour? And we did it at Talyard Studios, but despite that being Talyard Studios, famously the complex that contains several recording studios, we didn't record in one of the recording studios, we recorded in somebody's office, which would have been fine.
It was mainly made of glass, that office, which is not known for its soundproof qualities.
But it would have been fine had that police helicopter not decided to hover over Talyard for pretty much the entirety of our recording. But hey, police helicopters of London, you feel free to hover over Shepherd's Bush all you like, because this room has a little bit of soundproofing on it. So that should not be a problem. Talking of going on tour, I'm just back.
You are, yes.
From Helsinki.
I mean, that's pretty much normal, isn't it? That you're back from somewhere.
Yeah, not from Helsinki. That's the newsworthy bit. So
it's not the first time, though.
No, because I was over at Slush Music for the second time, it being the second edition of Slush Music. So Slush is this insanely big conference for startups and tech and entrepreneurs. And then Slush Music is the new event that they launched last year that is specifically focused on music. So some of the topics being discussed, you would find at other music conferences, not least the CMU Insights conferences at The Great Escape. But there is a specific focus on tech and on startups and what's happening next at that event. So I think it has actually quite quickly found an interesting niche that makes it a little bit different from all the many other music conferences that occur. We've set aside a whole section of Setlist this week for me to report back on what I learnt.
It does sound like you learnt quite a lot of things.
Well, I happened to be given, and it wasn't me that organised any of these panels, it was the Slush Music guys. They happened to give me some really interesting conversations to lead, which I will report back on. Although, I have to say the thing I'm going to remember most from this particular trip to Helsinki was having to climb up 30 flights of stairs at 2 o'clock in the morning when the fire alarm in the hotel where I was staying, which was a big tower block, quite a few Slush Music delegates were staying there. And at 2 o'clock in the morning on the Monday night, Tuesday morning, that thing, do you understand what I'm saying?
Yes.
2 o'clock in the morning. I didn't actually arrive at 1 o'clock in the morning because I got quite a late flight over. So I just gone to bed and then the fire alarm went off. And you do that thing where you get out of bed and you stand in the room and you're like, should I evacuate? Should I not evacuate? Should I evacuate? Should I not evacuate? Is this something you ignore? And so then you think, well, I'll go and open the door and see what other people are doing. So you open the door and then all along the corridor, people are standing there clearly going, should we evacuate? Should we not evacuate? And eventually we did. And so we went down. So I was on floor 13. So two flights
Unlucky
of stairs.
For you.
For me. So two flights of stairs per floor. And then the first floor, as often with hotels, it was a sort of big mezzanine type thing. So it was about 30 flights of stairs. And we got all the way to the bottom, out through a fire door, into the freezing cold Finnish night. And then back round to reception, where the most laid-back guy in the world, who as far as I could see was the only member of staff in the whole building, was like, it's fine, there's no fire, don't worry. The lifts did turn themselves off because of a fire drill. We don't know how to turn them back on. But it doesn't matter because we've got stairs. So you can all use the stairs, that's fine. The stairs are over there. And we all sort of stood there looking at each other, sort of saying, yeah, on the 13th floor. So I sat on the sofa in reception for half an hour, convincing myself that they would work out how to reboot the lifts.
Yeah.
But alas, they did not. So eventually I embarked on the 30 flights of stairs. But the next day at Slush Music, it was a way of bonding with all the other delegates who had been in the hotel that night. And we sort of started a game of who'd climbed the most stairs.
Who won?
Well, I was doing really well because most people I spoke to were on the 6th floor, 8th floor, 9th floor, and they were complaining and moaning, and I said, 13th floor. But I was told, I didn't actually manage to catch up with her, but I was told that Helly N of Audley and songwriting and music journalism fame was on floor 14. So
she beat one me better
by one floor. So she won the what may become traditional game of who climbed the most stairs at Slush Music competition.
If you go next, you'll have to set off the alarm in the morning to make sure.
So
demand a room on the top floor.
That will be one of my main memories of going to Slush Music. But there were also lots of really interesting conversations, of which more later.
Yes. Yeah, so at the end of this episode, we will run through some of your less fire alarm related memories, more music business related, more relevant to this show.
But maybe not as entertaining. We'll see.
Maybe not. We'll see.
But there's other things to do before then.
There are. We'll also be talking about Steely Dan's dispute between the one remaining living member of Steely Dan and the estate of the other founder member, who are in quite the legal tussle at the moment.
And yes, although this legal battle kicked off a couple of weeks ago, it definitely ramped up last week.
Yes, but first we're going to talk about another legal tussle, which has seen, well, not just a club, but a network of clubs potentially being forced to shut down in Birmingham. Rainbow Venues, which you may or may not know. It's a group of clubs and venues, 11 in total, I think, from large scale to smaller scale, who, similar to Fabric last year, have had their license revoked following a drug-related death at a club night in October. It's the second drug-related death of a young person there in the last 2 years, so the police pushed for the license to be revoked.
Well, the police said that they were obliged to. I mean, I don't quite know the exact rules and guidelines behind this, but the police officer who gave evidence as part of the hearing into this said that he was obliged, given that there had now been these two drug-related deaths at the venue within 2 years, in order to ask the council to consider revoking the licence.
Yeah, the officer representing West Midlands Police at the hearing last week said that despite measures to stop drugs getting into the club, it clearly wasn't possible to do that, and therefore they'd have to shut it all down, revoke the licence. They also claimed that a 15-year-old had been admitted to the venue, which they based on video evidence from Snapchat, which I'm not sure should be ever used as evidence of anything, but we'll come to that.
We used it as evidence of Jedward being in the Irish courts.
That's
the other
true,
week.
We did.
So it's not without precedent.
But there is no, this podcast is not legally binding in any way.
True.
So I think we're allowed to do that. But if you're presenting something in court, I don't think saying we've seen a video on Snapchat is something police should necessarily be saying.
No, and Rainbow Venues and the management team there, as well as confirming that they're going to appeal this decision. And this issue has been rumbling on for a few weeks in Birmingham, but sort of came to a head with the final decision actually saying we're going to revoke the license last week, as well as confirming they're going to appeal that decision and disputing various of the sort of statements that have been made as part of this, also disputed that allegation about the 15-year-old being given access to the club during a club night.
Yes, and while this obviously, as we said, this echoes the legal battle that Fabric found itself in last year, it also, from 2015, there are similarities with when the Arches in Glasgow was closed down, which we also discussed on the podcast. And I think that's what makes this a bigger story than the Fabric story, though obviously Fabric got a lot of press coverage and a huge campaign around it. But actually, this is not just about one club venue being shut down here. And it's, again, like Fabric, it's a club venue that was operating best practice policies on drugs, which I think everyone involved on both sides here would agree.
And as with Fabric, the venue did point out that to date they've had a pretty good relationship with the local police force, who have agreed that the practices that they operate and the various security stuff they have happening on the entrance and stuff happening in the actual venue itself. In the past, the police have said, yes, you are a good venue, one of the best in the city, one of the best in the country. And it's an exact parallel with Fabric, that seemingly they had a great relationship with the police over the years. The police have commended them for what they've done. And then suddenly a turn of events, a couple of albeit very tragic things happen there. And then they find themselves on the receiving end. And almost you do sense, as happened with Fabric, and it definitely happened with the Arches up in Glasgow, because these are best practice venues who have an ongoing relationship with the police and who do everything by the book and document everything. And they're always, you know, no questions asked. We call emergency services or the police whenever that is necessary. That almost comes back to haunt them because it means that the authorities then have a really good knowledge of everything that has happened there because of that, versus clubs who don't operate any of this, who sort of go under the radar, and therefore there isn't the paperwork or the document to use against them if and when something like this comes up.
Yeah, and as I said, this is a large group of venues. So aside from it just being bad that one club venue is being attacked, although it's obviously had a drug-related death there, two drug-related deaths there, and that's a sad thing, but it does feel like you say, this sort of, it's a venue that's trying its hardest to stop these things happening, and as a result of doing the right thing, is being attacked for it. But because it's such a large group of venues, it has a wider impact on Birmingham, both economically and culturally, because obviously it's got its main club space, which is its largest thing, and that's where they put on their big club nights. And they basically fund smaller events in their smaller venues.
And actually, that's
which is what the Arches was
exactly
doing.
That's where the direct parallel of the Arches is. That was what was great about the Arches. And I remember, as someone who often spends a month of their year in Edinburgh doing cultural stuff up there around the Edinburgh Fringe, and I always remember how the Edinburgh creative community were always so jealous of the Arches because they come up with this really great system where they ran these great club nights at the weekend that brought in a lot of money and a lot of bar money, and then they could use that to then use the space the rest of the week to do theatre stuff and educational stuff and workshop stuff, which basically was at best breaking even, probably losing money, but the whole business worked because they had these club nights. Rainbow venues have a very similar philosophy in the venues, and similarly they've sort of redeveloped what otherwise would have been derelict warehouses in a part of Birmingham. So again, a great system. We make money with our more commercial clubbing activity over here. We do all this great arty stuff over here. And I suppose that is the issue, that although the license being revoked, technically speaking, doesn't stop the other activities that are happening across the Rainbow complex, the point is commercially, it's the club bit that brings in the money that pays for everything else. So hopefully, although in some ways there's a closer parallel between this story and the Arches than there was between this story and Fabric in terms of the way the business runs and the bigger picture, let's hope that in terms of outcome, the parallel is closer to Fabric, because the Arches close down.
Yeah.
When it had similar run-ins with the licensing authorities, similar run-ins with the police authorities, again, everybody involved in that community felt that it was very unfair, and that, again, they were sort of misunderstanding the great work that that venue was doing in terms of trying to safeguard the safety of their club nights, where it is inevitable that some people will consume drugs. And even if you could stop them, I mean, we had this conversation when the whole Fabric thing was happening a year ago. Even if you could stop people taking drugs into the venue, as in their pockets or on their person or in their shoe or however it is that they're getting them through the door, you can't stop them taking drugs before they walk into the venue. And so what's better is venues like Fabric, Arches and Rainbow, that in addition to the security on the door, more importantly, have staff trained inside of what to do when something goes wrong. And so these are great venues that should be supported, and it just feels so frustrating that it's one of those things that just seems so obvious to us. It's sort of like, why don't they, you know, okay, perhaps there were lessons to be learned, perhaps there were new things that the club should be doing, but it just seems bizarre that the solution is, if we revoke the license, then everyone will stop taking drugs and it will never be a problem again.
Well, yeah, that was what the club said in its statement following its license being withdrawn, was that actually, they did have a stronger door policy than Fabric did at the point that it was shut down, because they had the sniffer dogs, which Fabric had resisted for reasons. I mean, Fabric argued, and other places have argued, that sniffer dogs aren't actually that effective. But they had sniffer dogs, they had random searches, they had CCTV on the door. They were doing everything they could to stop drugs getting in, but obviously drugs still were getting in, and they both the police and the club said, well, people will just come up with more creative ways to get drugs into the venue. They're still going to take them. But at least once they're inside, like you say, there's the medical attention they need. And the club said in its statement, by withdrawing our license, you aren't going to stop people taking drugs, you're just going to push them back to how it was previously, and particularly in the 90s when people, they were going to parties where they were less well looked after, and if they find them in a situation where they're in trouble, the people aren't there to help them out of that situation.
And indeed, there have been some horrible stories of those more unofficial shady clubs where when someone is clearly in a problem, their first response is to push them out of the building, so it's not the building's problem. And perversely, this sort of would say, actually, in a really horrific way, that would work, because by making it someone else's problem, you're saving the club. But that is completely and utterly the wrong way around. You've mentioned several times the parallels, as well as the Arches, with what happened at Fabric last year. Obviously, Fabric had a happy ending in that they managed to fight and they had a really good team behind them. And ultimately, they got their license back and they reached some agreements with their local council in order to make that happen. Of course, at the Senior Sites Conference at the Great Escape this year, just gone in May, which was a few months after the reopening, we put the spotlight on everything that happened there and also on the role that drugs have in club culture. And we did have some really interesting conversations at the Great Escape, some of which echoed what we've just been saying, but also some other really interesting insights came up.
Yeah, we interviewed various different people about this, including from Fabric and the Warehouse Project in Manchester. And we also spoke to Duncan Dick, who is the editor of Mixmag, and Mixmag obviously do their annual drug survey to see what the state of drug use is in the dance, music and clubbing community. And we had him come and give some of the stats from this year's survey and some of his views on the current nature of what's going on in the clubs. And they're saying it's actually, they found that of the people they classed as clubbers, as many as 79% had used ecstasy in 2016. So it's not like, oh, this is kind of the odd person doing this. It's quite a high level of people. And he was saying that trend has grown over the last 5 years. They actually found that more people had used MDMA than energy drinks in 2016. But in terms of like situations like this happening, which do seem to be becoming more common, one of the things he was saying was actually MDMA and ecstasy have been getting stronger over the last kind of 6 or 7 years. They got to a point where actually there was very little ecstasy or MDMA in anything you bought. But there's been a growing competition between the producers of it, kind of people based in the Netherlands producing it and new labs out of China. This competition has made the drugs get stronger and stronger as they try to sell more of their product and knock the other one out of the market. And as those have been getting stronger, people haven't necessarily, there's not the education there to let people know that this is happening.
Or at least the packaging or any official communication around the product.
No, obviously, your drug dealer isn't going to hand you a leaflet or telling you of the dangers of what you've just bought. People are going out and they don't know what's a safe dose anymore because things keep getting stronger and people find themselves in trouble. And sadly, some people find themselves dying because the drugs are changing. I mean, Duncan Dix was saying there is very little education out there on drugs from the government. He described the government's Talk to Frank scheme that's been going for quite a long time now as basically some leaflets in a club and a website and that's it. There's nothing else. So actually, I mean, Mixmag had been out and tried to do some education themselves and tried to do it in a way that wasn't kind of, oh, don't do that finger wagging thing. They had a campaign called Don't Be Daft, Start With a Half, which, well, obviously it's recognising that people are going to take drugs. So there's no point just going out saying, don't do it, but just saying, try to be a bit safer. And that's what's lacking currently. It's not the drugs policies of clubs, it's really that the government continues to turn a blind eye to it.
Yeah, and both Mixmag and also Vice, who we also had come and present about the content they've been doing around drugs, and I think both of those titles take the same attitude of their starting point is to say to an audience, we know you're going to take drugs, the safest way is to not, but if you are going to take drugs, this is what you need to know, this is what you should be doing, this is how you can be as safe as possible. And both those titles are doing that, but there's an element of, okay, they should both continue to do that, and perhaps in some ways they're always going to get the message across in a way that perhaps a government announcement can't. Those sort of public safety announcement things, immediately people are a bit resistant to them. But I think government should be learning from what these people are doing. And then, of course, there's the brilliant Loop charity, who, unfortunately, I wasn't able to get involved in the drugs conference at the Great Escape because the key person was speaking at another drugs conference that was happening elsewhere in Europe that happened to clash with our drugs conference, although that was a conference all about drugs rather than specifically music and drugs. But we are going to do a CMU Trends article talking to the people behind that charity, The Loop. So those are the people who have been going to clubs and to festivals and testing people's drugs and saying to them, this is what you've bought. So be aware, you have bought what you thought you bought, or actually what you've been sold there by your dodgy dealer is something quite different to what you thought that you had. And so either this is what you've got and you should educate yourself accordingly, or our advice to you would be that should just go straight in the bin. So I think initiatives like that are brilliant, and that is where the focus should be.
Yes, and where, and I guess the problem things like that have in setting up is that you have to get permission from the police, the council to do that sort of thing. And the starting point from them is always going to be, well, if someone brings in drugs, you've got to report them to us. And they have to say, but if we do that, no one will come in and it puts people in danger. As I say, we had Andy Blackett from Fabric at the CMU Insights conference as well. And he was saying they really had to push at Fabric when they wanted to bring medics in, just trained medical staff. They're not security. They're there to help people who are having a bad time or in trouble in some way. And they said they really had to push to make that tent a safe place where people knew if they came in, they weren't going to get in trouble. Because if they thought they were going to get passed on to the police, they're not going to go in there.
The other thing I thought was really interesting, and I think it was Sasha Lord from the Warehouse Project, so one of the other people that we had involved in the drugs conference, what he was saying, because obviously he does a lot up in Manchester, and he was saying just how much it varies where you are in the country. Although everyone is ultimately operating off the same UK-wide laws, that there was quite a lot of discretion at a local authority and a police force level. So in some parts of the country, the local authority, the local police would agree with everything that we've said. And in other parts of the country, they have very different opinions. And that's one of the issues. And I know one thing that Fabric talked about doing, and I assume they still are, we all really ought to go and catch up with what they are doing with some of that money they raised with the Big Safe Fabric campaign, was to also go to central government and say there is too much discretion at a local level. There is too much difference in how these policies are applied around the country. We need better guidelines on a national level to help the local authorities and the local police forces, who, to be fair, I suppose, if we're going to be fair to them, are concerned that they want to save lives. And they're not experts necessarily in how you do that. So it's sort of almost an education process of saying, well, what you're proposing isn't going to save any lives. These initiatives, while not perfect, will achieve a great deal more than what you are proposing. So Rainbow Venues have said they are going to appeal.
They have a 21-day window in which to do that.
And I do hope, and we're not necessarily talking to the right audience, it was great, the campaign that grew almost immediately around Fabric. I suppose because it was in London and it had a global reputation, and I suppose it had the label side, didn't it? And so lots of people knew it. There was a really big movement. And I think locally in Birmingham, the same thing is already happening. But because it's not London and therefore it doesn't quite have the attention of the wider music industry in the way that Fabric, I mean, lots of people in the music industry who'd never even been to Fabric really got behind that campaign. So I hope the same thing happens with Rainbow Venues in Birmingham, because it really felt like that campaign, when it came to the crunch, did help a lot. And yes. So I think anyone who feels strongly about this should get behind the Rainbow Venues in the same way they got behind Fabric. Because I think perhaps when the Arches happened down here at this end of the country, we were concerned about that, but we didn't really shout about it. And perhaps that's why that particular licensing run-in did not have a good ending. So let's all get behind the guys in Birmingham, I think is the message.
Still to come, some news in brief, plus Chris's roundup from the Slush Music Conference. But now, a bit of legal dispute has blown up between Steely Dan's Donald Fagen and the estate of his songwriting partner, Walter Becker, who died in September. Fagen claims that the band signed an agreement in 1972 with a clause that said if a member of the band quit or died, the remaining members would have the option to buy their stake of the band's business. Fagen is now the last remaining member of the group, and only he and Becker had stakes in the band at the time of Becker's death. And now Fagen wants to buy that 50%.
Yes, so this is ultimately a contractual dispute, because what Fagen has said is that, well, there's a bit of a dispute as exactly what's happening. What Fagen is saying is that almost as soon as Becker had died, legal representation for his estate got in touch with Fagen to say, oh, FYI, as far as we're concerned, that buy-sell agreement in your old contract from the 1970s doesn't apply. What the estate are saying is it was the other way around, that Fagen immediately got in touch, almost the day after it had been announced that Becker had died, to say, oh, by the way, there's this clause in this old contract, I'm planning on enforcing it, I will now control the business. So, yes, Fagen has gone legal to try and enforce this contract and to say we had this buy-sell agreement. As of a month ago, there were only two shareholders left in the Steely Dan business, and I will now buy out Becker's share and I will have complete control of the Steely Dan business. Meanwhile, the estate are arguing, because they have issued a statement following Fagen filing this lawsuit, and their position is that buy-sell agreement from 1972 no longer applies.
Yeah, so as you say, having gone legal in mid-November, Fagen is now asking the LA County Superior Court to enforce the 1972 contract and hand over control of the Steely Dan website, which apparently Walter Becker's people are in charge of.
Yeah, there's also a complaint about a company that's been providing services for the band's business in recent years, who, obviously, we don't know the backstory to this yet. It may come out if it actually gets to court, but you sort of get the sense that perhaps it was this company that's been providing services for the Steely Dan brand and for the Steely Dan business, and that perhaps the relationship between that company was really with Becker rather than Fagen, and that he sort of now feels that he now has a disconnect, and as far as we can see, that company is sitting on the website, possibly an email list that goes with it. So he is saying, yes, two things. I want it to be confirmed that I will now exclusively own the Steely Dan business, and B, I need access to all that information and data that this company are sitting on so that I can get on with running the band and running the business.
So without actually seeing the contract, it's quite hard to say who is in the right here, although we can speculate about the motives behind it.
Yeah, I did a little interview with Newsweek this week about this. That was their first question. Who's in the right, who's in the wrong? And it's sort of like, well, this is a contractual dispute. Sagan's lawyer has been very clear. It is a contractual dispute. It's all based on the terms of this 1972 contract and whether or not they still stand. So without seeing that contract, and indeed any subsequent contracts, because I assume there's a reason why the Becker estate seem confident that that 1972 agreement no longer stands. I don't know whether that is because of the wording of the 1972 agreement or whether there have been subsequent agreements that they think renders that particular buy-sell clause void. So we don't actually currently have access to that information. If this does get to court, then presumably we will get to see more information about what was agreed. Another question that the journalist from Newsweek asked is, well, what would the Steely Dan company or business, what does it actually control? What is it that Sagan actually wants control of? Because obviously bands create a number of different things, different assets, different kinds of intellectual property. There's the copyright on the songs, the copyright on the recordings, but also there's the brand. And of course, these days, there is the website and the mailing list and the social media and having control of that director-fan relationship. And generally, when bands come together and form a business, there are lots of different ways bands can formalise that business. And lots of different bands do it in different ways. And I think most of the lawyers I speak to often say there isn't a right and wrong way of doing it. Just make sure you write it down when everything's agreed. But then they did write it down.
Yes.
And that's still causing a problem.
Well, I suppose that's what... You can write something down and when your band folds 5 years later, well, you've got that agreement that you wrote 5 years ago. But in this case, it's 45 years later. And a lot can happen in 45 years.
In terms of the various different assets, the song copyrights are usually outside of this. And actually, a more recent comment by Fagan's lawyer was basically saying that. So if Fagan goes on to perform a Steely Dan on his own, but performs songs that he co-wrote with Becker, then Becker would be due the performing right royalties.
Or Becker's estate.
Or Becker's estate would be due the performing right royalties on those songs, which would be paid by the promoter into the collective licensing system, and all of that. So the song copyrights usually would sit outside any band agreement and belong to the individual writers. Also, often in bands, there will be band members who will be cut into the business but don't write songs. So they are not part of the song rights. In terms of the recording rights, well, that's really hard to know. Obviously, quite often it's actually a record company that controls the recording rights. But even if a record company does control the recording rights, who do they pay the royalties to? Do they pay the royalties to each individual band member, or do they pay a band company that then pays the band members? But I think this dispute, as I say, this is speculation, but I speculate this really is about the brand and the name and ultimately the right to tour with that name. And I suspect that that is what Fagan is keen to continue to control, so that he can carry on performing as Steely Dan, touring as Steely Dan, and not have to hand over big chunks of the ticket money to the Becker estate or to get a license to use a name from the Becker estate, which almost
Well, we talked recently, didn't we?
About the Frank Zappa.
Yeah, Dweezil Zappa having to pay a license to his father's estate, of which he is a beneficiary anyway, in order to tour the Zappa Plays Zappa show.
And of course, there are loads of examples of bands and pop groups in history where different band members go different ways. And then there is the debate about, well, who has the right to perform under the original band's name? Who needs? I mean, we had two UB40s for a few months a couple of years ago, didn't we?
Because we've got Bucks Fizz and formerly of Bucks Fizz.
Because these groups can't decide who has the name. But ultimately, there will be some agreement somewhere that says, actually, the name, the brand belongs to this person or this group of people. And therefore, anyone else, once they've quit the band, even if they are performing the songs of their former band, even if they are the former frontman or frontwoman, so they are actually what people often associate, they will have to do so under either their own name or a variation of that name. So I suspect that that is really what is at the heart of this dispute and why Fagan is trying to enforce his contract. At the moment, both sides are doing some quite tough talking, given that actually Becker's only... He died a couple of months ago.
Yeah.
This has really taken off really quickly. But whether or not behind the scenes any talks are ongoing. I mean, one of the allegations Becker's estate made was that they have been trying to reach a deal with Fagan's lawyer. We don't know whether this is true, but this is what Becker's estate are claiming. They've been trying to do deals with Fagan's lawyer, but Fagan keeps sacking his lawyer. So twice now, they thought they'd really reached an agreement, and then Fagan sacked the lawyer, and then the third lawyer doesn't seem, they say, to want to sit down and hammer out a deal. So tough talking.
He doesn't want to get sacked.
Tough talking on both sides. It will be interesting to see whether or not it does get to court. I suspect they will ultimately reach a deal, but at the moment they are both issuing quite stern statements.
Just quickly, time for some news in brief now, and it's that time of year. It's tipping bans for the top for the next 12 months' time.
Ones to watch.
Yes, so the big polls of the year, the BBC Sound Of poll and the Brits Critics' Choice, both came out last week.
Both of which you vote for.
Both of which I do vote for.
So it's your fault. Are you willing to take responsibility? You actually think that the Brits Critics' Choice in particular is a pretty strong shortlist this year.
I did not vote for any of those three artists. However, I think it's a good list. It's also, I mean, I made a joke in the Daily that this would be the first time that it was guaranteed that someone good would win. It's actually the first time that it's guaranteed that a woman will win, because it's the first time it's ever been three women up for the prize, which it itself, that's exciting. It's Georgia Smith, Mabel and Stefflon Don.
So they're all up for the Brits Critics' Choice Award, which is the new talent Brit that is actually announced and presented before the event. They usually actually present the gong to the winner when they announce the shortlist for the rest of the awards. So that's the Critics' Choice. And actually, we find out who the winner is quite soon, don't
yes.
we? Whereas Sound Of 2018, the BBC poll, which I know we say this every year, but I always think it's worth reminding ourselves that this just began as an article on the BBC website, because the entertainment reporter on BBC Online back in the day was trying to look for something to write about in the run-up to Christmas, and so he did a quick poll of some journalists. And now it's become a really big thing, and so they will announce the top five in the new year with the overall winner. It's a longer list. Do we have time for you to run through it?
I can run through it quickly, but before we get to it, because it's normally 15, it's actually 16 names this year, because there was a draw between the 15th and 16th place artists. I don't know who it was, but I'm pretty sure I'm right in saying this is the first time that there's no crossover between the Sound Of and the Critics' Choice shortlist, or longlist and shortlist. Actually, Georgia Smith and Stefflon Don both appeared in the Sound Of 2017 longlists. Georgia Smith came fourth in that. That either shows that the Sound Of poll is getting ahead of itself if these artists are actually going to be a lot bigger in 2018.
All the Brits Critics' Choice goes to old news artists.
Yeah, although, I mean, I wouldn't say, although, well, Georgia Smith, Mabel and Stefflon Don have all done well in 2017. I would say it's probably right to say that they'll do better. They're all primed to get bigger in 2018, so it appears that they're coming onto this poll at the right time. We'll see.
Why don't you quickly run us through the Sound Of 2018 long list, which is apparently full of the sounds of 2019.
Yeah, so in 2019, you'll be listening to Alma, Billie Eilish, IMDDB, Jade Bird, Khalid, Louis Capaldi, Nullifer, Yanya, Notes, Pale Waves, Rex Orange County, Sam Fender, Sigrid, Superorganism, Tom Walker, Yaeji, and Young Bane. So that's all 16 of those. Traditionally, I think I comment on all of them, but they're all so boring. I can't be bothered.
All right. So you're
actually no. I quite like Sigrid, but otherwise, Superorganism are okay.
You're impressed with the Critics' Choice shortlist, and you're very nonplus about the Sound Of 2018. So
I'm not looking. If this is the Sound Of 2018, I'm not looking forward to it.
Well, as we've already established, the Critics' Choice list are going to be the Sound Of 2018. It's the Sound Of 2019. So you've got a whole year to prepare yourself.
I mean, I get really annoyed when people just say, oh, it's just, they're all so boring. But they really are. I think it's just that I'm getting old. No.
Well, you've been old for quite some time, so that's not
so
changed this year. But there you go. In early Jan, we will find out of these 16 lackluster mediocre bands, who are the five most exciting.
Well, if they're not that exciting, maybe this next story will will be more depressing next year, because apparently the UK's creative sector is growing twice as fast as the wider economy. At the moment, the entire creative sector, not just music, is worth £92 billion.
That's the GVA, that figure that we use when we try to assess the value of sectors to the economy. So, yeah, this is from the Department of... Hang on a second, they changed their name earlier this year. The Department of Digital, Culture, Media and Sport.
Yeah.
Maybe not in that order. I can never quite remember
the order.
What order they list them in. So this is the creative industries. So, yeah, music, movies, TV, Advertising is in there, which you may or may not consider to be part of the creative industries. Gaming is in there. Gaming and other digital stuff is helping the growth. I mean, we talk a lot about how the music industry is in growth, the record industry is in growth, but if you look at what's really fueling the growth of the wider creative industries, it is the gaming and digital sectors that are doing it. But still, growth. Woo!
In other UK government news, the Competition and Markets Authority has announced that it's going to crack down on secondary ticketing sites that it feels are not adhering to the rules.
So yes, the CMA has been investigating the secondary ticketing market in the UK for a while now and the big four resale sites and said that it is planning on taking action to enforce existing consumer rights rules that apply to these sites. It implied that one more than the others has not been even sticking to the commitments it made directly to the CMA, let alone the laws that govern secondary ticketing. I think we can probably guess which one that is, but we won't comment yet. Presumably we'll find out. So yes, various people who've been fighting for better regulation of secondary ticketing have welcomed this, including the Fanfare Alliance, although the devil is in the detail. So we will see, I guess, in the new year exactly how they're going to go about enforcing the rules.
Yes, so you could read all of those stories and all of the stories that we're discussing this week, except for what we're about to discuss, because actually I don't think we've written anything about Slush Music yet, but that's just complicating matters. Go to setlistpodcast.com. You'll find the show notes for this episode and all of our previous episodes. And you can go in there and you'll find links to all of the stories. You can read more about them there. And finally this week, as promised, we're going to have a roundup of the Slush Music Conference from my colleague, Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Hello.
Welcome to the podcast. I'm going to interview you about a thing that you did now.
And which we've already talked about
yes.
at quite some length at the start of this podcast. I went to Helsinki, there was a fire alarm, 13 floors.
Well, that sounds interesting, why don't you tell us about that?
I think I've probably covered that. Except to say, after climbing 13 floors, I felt that I deserved a little glass of orange juice out of the minibar, tiny little bottle of orange juice. When I was leaving the hotel, they said, for the minibar, I said I had a little glass of orange juice because after climbing 30 flights of stairs, 13 floors, I thought I deserved it. I really thought they were going to let me off the €3. But they were so like, whatever, €3, please. But anyway. But yes, the actual conference. Ask me about the Slush Music Conference.
So Slush Music, I think I'm right in saying, because you said earlier, is in its second year, although Slush is older. It's mainly focused on digital stuff. And Slush Music, obviously digital stuff in music. So you looked at various things, you sat on various panels. Let's run through the things that you looked at. The first thing I think you talked about, and so the first thing we'll cover here is piracy.
Yeah, day one, because Slush Music this year was a two-day event, having only been a one-day event last year. So yeah, on the first day, I sat down with Andy Chatterley, who runs the UK-based company Muso, who I last spoke to at The Great Escape a few years ago now about his platform. So his platform, at its heart, helps rights owners, not just in music, but we were there talking about music, monitor piracy sites, see when their content is being shared without license, and then those sites that do respond to the takedown notices that we've talked about a lot on the podcast, their system will allow you to issue those takedowns in a really simple way. So that's what Muso does, although we were there specifically to look at all of the stats that he's been pulling out of his platform as to what is happening with music piracy in 2017.
Yeah, so we've discussed a lot recently because it's been a big topic in the music industry, stream ripping. And how stream ripping is now the scourge of the music industry. It's the biggest problem that all labels face. Is that what Muso has found?
Well, that was probably the most interesting slide that he presented. He had a pie chart that basically broke down all the different kinds of piracy in music that they are seeing happening. So there was still torrent sharing on the Pirate Bay, etc. And there was still a little bit of sharing through digital lockers and people sharing links on message boards. Stream ripping, from their stats, was about a quarter of the piracy pie. I've introduced the piracy pie now in addition to the digital pie. These are 2016 figures, I should stress, because he wanted to show figures for a whole 12 months. But the single biggest kind of piracy, as far as their stats are concerned, over 40% were on unlicensed, illegal streaming services, most of which we've never heard of.
Yeah, this isn't something that although we have obviously had the Groove Shark issue a few years ago, but this isn't something that the IFPI, the RIAA, BPI are sending us press releases about.
No, I mean, I assume they're aware of it, but it's not something that's being talked about. And indeed, most of the conversation, as you say, in the last 18 months, when it comes to piracy, is about stream ripping. I mean, that said, piracy itself is not the talking point it once was. We've referenced on many occasions, and I went through the whole, we get press releases and they always follow the same template thing that we've talked about in the podcast on stage, the fact that because Value Gap, Safe Harbor, YouTube has been the big lobbying push from the music industry, a lot less talk about piracy at all, but where there is talk about piracy these days, it tends to be about stream ripping. Obviously, YouTubeMP3.org was pushed off the internet through litigation earlier this year. But yeah, Andy has all of these illegal streaming services, so they work a little bit like Spotify. Most of them, I think, are desktop-based, although a couple do now have mobile apps. I think they mainly pull their content in off the file-sharing network. So they pull content off the digital lockers, and for people who are file-sharing content through things like the Pirate Bay, it pulls in all of that content and then presents it with a Spotify-type experience. Although Andy did say that they're not particularly good experiences when put alongside a Spotify or a Deezer or a Tidal Apple Music. So they're not as sophisticated or as helpful. But I suppose, first of all, they are totally free. And you say, well, Spotify's free, but you don't get full functionality on Spotify for free, particularly on mobile.
And you get adverts.
Plus you get the ads. So there is that element to it. And obviously catalogue, as much as the legit streaming services like to talk up the 40, probably nearly 50 million tracks they now have in their systems, in terms of every track that has ever been released, that's only a slice of the wider catalogue. And okay, a lot of the other music that has never been properly officially ingested is music that most people aren't interested in, but some people are. And often the piracy platforms, because it's crowdsourced its content, will have old catalogue releases that have never been officially put into a Spotify. And he did say, and of course there's pre-release content, the people who are leaking the content before it lands even on a SoundCloud or a YouTube. So there is that element to it. And of course, there are markets where the Spotifys of this world are yet to launch. And in those countries, YouTube is usually the dominant streaming service, but this would be another option for those people. So it was interesting to find out that just how significant those have become. I have to assume that they will start to work their way up what I call the piracy gripe list. And yeah, we will start to hear about these from the record companies and music publishers in the next year or so. And possibly from the Spotifys and Apple Musics of this world, who, if their sign-ups start to slow down, at the moment both Spotify and Apple Music in particular are adding lots of new subscribers every month, but if that starts to slow down and they still need growth in order to be viable businesses, they might start to look at these services. And obviously the stream services in Europe have just launched their own little lobbying organisation in Brussels, so perhaps that's something they'll be talking about. Although, of course, there is the issue that one of Spotify's lines to its critics in the music industry, ever since they first arrived 10 years ago, is that we've turned pirates into consumers. We've taken all those people who in the 2000s were accessing music illegally, we've got them on our platform, we've helped you get business out of people who used to pirate music. So they don't necessarily want to talk about all the new streaming piracy services.
Well, it is interesting, obviously, as consumers of music through legitimate licensed services shift from downloads to streaming, it appears that pirates are as well. Pirates are more keen to have the access rather than the ownership, have the mobile experience.
No, and one thing that I said, I mean, that's definitely that all the piracy trends completely match the trends we're seeing in legitimate digital music. And one thing I was saying to Andy is, while everyone's got very angry about stream ripping in the last 18 months, I mean, his stats showed that as soon as they shut down YouTube MP3, he could see the other services that got those YouTube MP3 users immediately went over to the competitors, which obviously is why the BPI and the IFPI and the RIAA are now saying to government, we need to shut down all of these stream ripping sites. But part of me feels that ultimately, those piracy services that involve a download, like the Pirate Bay or like the stream ripping sites, could ultimately burn themselves out. It's not that legislation and litigation will ultimately get rid of them. It's just you've got a whole new generation coming through for whom the notion of a download is irrelevant. They're not interested in downloading music. They just want to have access to it. They want offline listening, and we know that behind the scenes that requires a download, but that's not how they think about it.
Yeah.
And so you'll have a whole generation for whom a piracy service that involves something downloading to your device in an overt fashion don't care about that, and so these illegal streaming services could be the target. There were lots of other interesting stats in that talk, including they'd done some maths around the Taylor Swift window release. We've not got time to talk about them now, but we are putting out a CMU Trends article about that particular session at Slush, so premium subscribers will be able to access more of Andy's stats and a little summary of current trends in piracy through CMU Trends on the website.
So we're running out of time, but let's run through a few of the other things you talked about while you were over there in Helsinki. Evolving label deals.
So this session linked in to the deals guide that we published with the MMF here in the UK a few weeks ago, and MMF at UK talks to all the other MMFs in the world, and they are very interested in the digital dollar world. So MMF Finland were involved in getting me over to Slush Music. So this was sort of the key session I was there to host. And it was looking at how the way artists work with labels and distributors or whatever it is that we're calling these companies is evolving. And we had a lawyer from the UK, a lawyer from the Nordic region, and a representative of the IFPI there. And I suppose the conclusion was that there is no off-the-shelf record deal anymore. And one thing that one of the lawyers was saying is how back in the heyday of the CD, there was probably two, maybe three deals to pick from if you were signing to a label. So one was a distribution deal, one was a 50-50 rev share that some of the smaller indies would offer, and the other was a straight label deal, and that was pretty much it. And obviously, in the deals guide, I've identified 10 deals, so we've gone from 3 to 10. Although what they were saying is, but of course in those 10 deals, as indeed the deals guide says, there is then quite a lot of flexibility. So yes, you could say, ultimately, there's an infinite number of deals there. There are the 10 basic templates that we've identified.
Well, it's not even just choosing between an indie label and a major label anymore. It's just choosing between different sorts of companies and who you hand over your rights to and what percentage of those rights you hand over and what services you buy in return. It might be that you hand over no rights and you buy services in return.
And perhaps the most interesting thing to come out of the conversation at Slush Music, which is one of the reasons why MMF UK is talking to MMFs elsewhere in the world, is that not only are there the different deal types, but those deal types vary from country to country. And actually, it's interesting. If you look at our 10 deals, we start off with the DRI distribution. And actually, DRI distribution is operating pretty much the same globally. There might be a handful of little differences because of local copyright law. But ultimately, deal set 1, 2, 3 are now global. Once you get up to the more classic record deals, they still vary a lot from country to country. And what you will get, what you'll have to give up, varies greatly if you do the deal in the UK or the Nordics or Germany or the US. And one thing we're hoping to look at in the next year is how those deals differ. If you do a deal in Canada versus Germany versus the UK, with a DIY distribution deal, it probably makes no difference. But with an indie label or major label deal, actually it can make quite a big difference. And so that's a bit of work that we're hoping to be doing next year. This is all TBC, but this is our ambition. And as and when we do that, we will report back on it through CMU, CMU Trends, and here on Setlist.
And lastly, let's talk about artificial intelligence. What's going on with artificial intelligence in music?
Well, lots is going on with artificial intelligence in music. We do not have time to tell you about all of it. We almost don't have time to tell you about the one thing I was there to talk about. Although the good news is that the conversation I started in Helsinki last week, we will be continuing in Brighton in May of The Great Escape. More about CMU Insights conferences at The Great Escape 2018 coming up in the new year. But I can confirm that we will be looking at some of the AI technologies in music and the conversation I had, which was really interesting at Slush Music last week, about the copyright implications of those AI technologies that are creating music. So as machines start to create music, and there are now platforms out there that are soundtracking video. So one of the startups involved in the conversation that I moderated at Slush has a system where you upload a video and you can either fill out a form and then it will create some music for your video, or you can just say to the system, here's my video, you create a soundtrack. And the machines are doing that. And that software is getting ever more sophisticated. One of the questions is, will those machines ultimately start writing commercially released pop songs? At the moment, it's mainly production music, soundtrack music. But as the machines start writing songs, well, who owns the copyright in those songs? Because a machine can't own a copyright. But the songwriter owns the rights in the song. So who's the songwriter? So we had a big discussion about how does copyright law deal with that. Somewhere in the chain there will be a human being, although probably there will be multiple human beings. Which of those should be the default copyright owner? And although on one level contracts can rewrite all of that anyway, so who cares? But remember, when it comes to the song copyright, the length of the copyright is based on somebody's life.
Yeah.
So which person in the chain we decide, okay, that's the default copyright owner, even if contracts then immediately rewrite that, that is important because it will affect how long the copyright runs for. So lots of interesting, albeit speculative conversations that we started in Helsinki last week, and we will be continuing in Brighton next year. So yeah, get your Great Escape tickets now.
Oh, a little plug.
Little plug there.
Well, it's all very interesting. Obviously, we can't go into it in massive detail now, but hopefully it's something we can come back to here as well as in other conversations in the future. But that is all we have time for
this
now.
This has ended up being quite a long edition of the podcast. We had a lot to talk about. We've been doing really speedy podcasts for the last few weeks. Clearly, being on tour has affected our ability to be concise.
If, as I suggested, we recorded it while walking around a park, I think it would have been shorter.
It would have been a lot shorter. It is very cold. Thanks just once again to IE Music and to Stephen O'Reilly for providing us with this lovely little soundproof room in which to record our podcast this week. We should be back in our usual location in East London next week.
Now, at this stage last week, I asked people to send in pictures of their dogs dressed as rappers. Someone actually did.
Oh, did they?
So this week, I mean, why not tweet your pictures of your pets dressed as pirates this week? That would, I'm going to branch out from dogs.
Because we've just been talking about piracy.
To just, yes.
Right.
So we've been talking about piracy.
I understand.
I mean, I don't know, it'd be hard to dress your pet up as a artificially intelligent songwriter, but you could try. If you can do that, go ahead, knock yourself out. You'll find us on all the social media that matter, and also LinkedIn. Or you can email us, setlist@unlimitedmedia.co.uk. Setlist is the music business podcast from CMU. It's presented by me, Andy Malt, and Chris Cook. For more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Setlist is an Unlimited production.